Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 11:29 a.m. and that is December 27th. And today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. We're in the last few trading days of the year and there aren't many people at their desks. It's generally speaking, it tends to be a rather illiquid time of the year for trading. What it also affords people is the opportunity to try and change a trend. If you've got sufficient capital in an illiquid market, then there is the opportunity to punt and to pressure shorts or to pressure stops. And it is quite normal that at this time of the year we see a dynamic move appear somewhere. And on this occasion, it does look like it's going to be the US dollar is what people are going to come back to in January and say, well, golly, something big happened with the US dollar over Christmas. If we cast our minds back to last year, then it was the phone call that Steve Mnuchin put into the various CEOs of banks and said, right, we're going to have to come in and start to support the stock market. That happened on December 26th. By the time people got into their desks in early January, the market was rallying. Well, today it is the dollar falling. This is a significant downward dynamic from the region of the trend mean. And when we look at the US dollar's index's trend over the course of the last couple of years, well, it had a significant bounce at the beginning of 2018, but it encountered resistance around the psychological 100 level about 3 months ago. Since then, it's held a sequence of lower rally highs. It is encountering resistance now in the region of the trend mean, and there is the potential now that it is going to break its sequence of higher reaction lows. Well, the dollar index is primarily euro and yen, and the yen, particularly against the US dollar, has been rather steady, and I think that's helping to support the dollar index. I think when we just simply look at the euro cross rate, well, I think then we can start to see that we have a higher reaction low, and we are looking now at a higher high, particularly when viewed on a closing basis. Then when we think about the fact that the euro has been almost uniquely unloved, investors have been really castigated European leadership for their inability to agree on fiscal stimulus, also for the haphazard way in which various governments and the European Union have tried to address the debt issues that have been accrued over the course of the last 30 or even 40 years. When we think about Europe and the fact that there isn't any cohesive, or there isn't, I suppose, one person to call when you want to know about Europe, that it is all at the behest of various governments, well, then you have all of these arguments, but the euro does look like it is going to move higher from here. It was up in a dynamic manner today. It is now back above the trend mean. We're at a new closing high, at least over the course of the last 4 months. But the much bigger picture is that a number of the clear supports that have helped to hold the dollar up over the course of the last couple of years are now gone. And we've had something of a delayed reaction in terms of the dollar's response. But the clearest change that we've had right now is in the size of the Fed's balance sheet. They've added $100 billion a month for the last 4 months. It's up $400 billion since October. And this is a faster pace of adding reserves to their balance sheet than we've seen since 2008. This is a profound change. This isn't something that is a blip. This isn't something that is going to be simply written off as meaning nothing at all. This is an incredibly important change to monetary policy. The supply of US dollars is now increasing at the fastest pace since the teeth of the credit crisis in 2008. And that is negative for the dollar. When you increase the supply of a vital resource in a very profound manner, then it is logical that the price of that asset starts to decline, at least on a relative basis. But of course, we're talking about currencies. The only way that you can talk about any currency is on a relative basis. And this is a really quite important move because it represents a massive capital infusion. If we're looking for any particular reason why stock markets have been able to break out to new highs over the course of the last 2 months, then that's it. It's that there is this massive source of additional liquidity hitting the market. When we then think about the size of central bank balance sheets, it has also been able to push up and is now again testing the 20 trillion level. Well, we've had a really quite impressive rebound since October, but the most important thing is that it has broken its sequence of lower rally highs. This is now suggesting that we are back in a supply, it is a supply-dominated environment for central bank assets. They're supplying the global economy with ample liquidity. There is the clear potential that it is going to go back above the 20 trillion level. One thing that I think is really important is when we look at the ECB's balance sheet, they're the only central bank that tried to take anything close to the quantity of money out of circulation that the Fed has just tried to do. And in an effort to avert the deflation that that created, they had to put in 2.5 times more. Well, that suggests that the Federal Reserve's balance sheet is going to get significantly larger. The more important point is, and this is a very important longer term phenomena, is the range of duties the Federal Reserve has had to absorb has increased again. Now they are taking full responsibility for the repo markets. And they have not yet announced that they have a standing repo facility, but there is no other potential source of liquidity in the world that is capable of providing the kind of liquidity that the repo market requires. And therefore, we have a standing repo facility because there is absolutely no way that the Federal Reserve can tolerate the potential that the repo market will no longer function as it is designed to do. Well, I think this is incredibly important because what it is basically saying is that now we have a clear example of how the Federal Reserve has become the central banker to the world. It is no longer simply about the US economy. It is about the global economy. And they have taken on that responsibility in large part because of the raft of regulations that were imposed upon the financial sector in the aftermath of the credit crisis. Then there is the voracious appetite for capital from the federal government, which is running trillion-dollar deficits. If we had to think about another headwind for the value of the dollar, it is those deficits. But then we also have to consider that the Federal Reserve had been trying to run counter-cyclical policy. They had been trying to contract the size of their balance sheet and raise interest rates against a background where the Trump tax cuts had contributed to these record-sized deficits. Well, they were disabused of their ability to run that kind of policy when the stock market pulled back first by 10%, then by nearly 20%. Since this time last year, the or any attempt to run counter-cyclical policy has literally gone out the window. And there is just no way that that is going to be tolerated by investors. What that suggests is that we are still in a liquidity-fueled environment. This has been a liquidity-fueled bull market on Wall Street for most of the decade, and it is still the motive force behind the breakouts to new highs. I think it's particularly useful to look at a range of currency pairs against the US dollar. So for example, the Australian dollar has now broken its sequence of lower rally highs, and the downtrend has been broken, and there is potential here for additional upside. When we look at the South African rand against the dollar, usually we look at this the other way around, but it looks like it is now testing the sequence of lower rally highs. Wasn't quite able to hold all of the advance in here today, but this does look like support building. The Brazilian real has also been ranging for most of the last couple of months, and it is starting to steady once more and testing its sequence of lower rally highs. The New Zealand dollar has been leading on the upside and has now pushed back above the trend mean once more and confirmed support in the region of the lows from 2015. The Mexican peso, which has been forming a triangular pattern over the course of the last few months, has now broken its sequence of lower rally highs and does look like we are back in a demand-dominated environment. We can certainly think about the commonality that we see in some of these currencies, that it is, and this is the, I will just show them all the same way around. The Russian ruble also looks like it is firming from a previous area of support. Well, they are in many respects either commodity related currencies, or we're talking about the deeply oversold currencies like the euro and indeed the pound. And the pound has bounced from the region of its trend mean in here today, in fact. What this is suggesting is we've had just the first consolidation following the rebound from 120 and the lows put in back in 2016, and now we're starting to see support beginning to be to come through once more. Well, the UK is relatively undervalued relative to other developed markets, and there is the clear potential that that undervaluation is going to disappear over the course of the next 12 months or perhaps 2 years. Europe has been out on the sidelines, or really indeed I think the hinterland of global investment for most of the last decade, because of the risk that we're going to have a breakup of the European Union, or the continued demise of the euro, or the fact that nobody really knows what the knock-on of negative interest rates and negative yielding bonds is going to be over the medium to long term. But when we think about everything that that people have been worried about this year, there are partial solutions available for just about all of them. And the easing of the trade war, and the fact that the UK now has single-party government once more with a sizable majority, those are really quite positive developments. If we are at a point where the trade war between the USA and China is at least on hiatus, then there is the clear potential for a reflation trade. Then that also removes one of the clear supports for the US dollar, because a lot of investors had simply wanted dollars because it represented a safe haven. Well, when we look at the Japanese yen against the US dollar, it has been very quiet. And The yen was a little bit steadier today against the US dollar, but I don't think that this is the most instructive currency pair, because the yen also tends to catch a bid when we have stress in the global economy. It's when we compare the yen to the kind of countries that it is competitive against, such as the European Union, then we have the euro breaking its sequence of lower rally highs against the yen. Or when we look at the yen versus the Korean won, and of course Japan and South Korea compete in a substantial number of export markets, and here also we have the Korean won breaking its sequence of lower rally highs and also finding support in the region of the trend mean now. So what that suggests is that there is scope here for the yen to weaken, but most particularly against the countries against which it competes, like Germany or much of the rest of Europe or South Korea. Then when we think about the Japanese stock market, the Nikkei is back at the upper side of a two-year range. Now, it is somewhat overbought in the short term, and we may yet see some additional consolidation. But as long as it's holding the region of the trend mean, I think we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. And when we look at this chart on a long-term basis, well, then we can see that 20,000 had been an area of resistance for an awfully long time, decades, and now it is representing an area of support. With this whole two-year range looks like a first step above the base. It is equally true of the FTSE 100, which has been ranging now for 3 years and is now starting to push back up towards the upper side of its range. But this has been a three-year first step above what was effectively a 17-year base formation. And then when we think about the European stock market, just looking at a broad Europe index, it ranged below 400 for most of the last 4 years, but it has had 400 as a psychological area of resistance for the last 20 years, and now it is just starting to break on the upside. International investors like to have the potential for either capital market expansion, yield, or the currency on their side. Well, in Europe, there is the potential here that the euro is going to rally further. The valuation is certainly more attractive than we have on Wall Street, and there is the scope that we're going to see potential for additional upside as a result of those particular factors. If the dollar is now going to trend downwards, not just on a short-term basis, but over the medium term, well, that is something that is going to throw an additional argument into the global conversation, which is that the efforts that are underway by governments everywhere, not just in the USA, to try and avoid a recession, have been clearly demarked by efforts to run deficits. We can call it fiscal stimulus, we can call it deficit spending, we can call it spending money you don't have. Running up a credit card balance on a personal basis is something that will eventually cause trouble. There is absolutely no question that it's going to cause trouble eventually for governments. But as long as those deficits are expanding, and as long as the economy continues to expand with it, then people are more than happy to run with the trend. The last time we saw anything like this was when Gordon Brown was running deficits to expand social services in the UK. And that created a boom, and it resulted in a period of outsized growth and great enthusiasm about potential, and consumers were really very happy because they all had more money in their pockets. But of course, when the credit crisis hit, it put the UK in a very tight position. A number of banks went bust, and then of course the pound took the brunt of the selling pressure. Running substantial deficits is eventually going to cause a problem, but this is increasingly a global phenomenon. Every country is doing the same thing. They are all flogging their own currencies, and they are all engaged in debasing those currencies. It would probably be the best way to think about it. And as a result, gold continues to recover. Well, this also looks like a first step above the base. And that base is approximately 6 years old. When we then go back and look at the consistency of the trend, well, we had these ranges, one above another. And I think when we want to see those ranges, it is probably better to look at a logarithmic scale chart, because it puts things in terms of percentages. Then we clearly see the ranges one above another. We can also see that there was a base formation, that we had the initial pop on the upside resulted in an almost 2 year period of consolidation before we got the subsequent breakout and consolidation again. And that is eerily similar to what we had on this occasion. I think the fact that will not be lost on investors is the last time we had a significant bull market in gold, the market went from $250 to approximately $2,000, so not all that far away from a 10x move. And we have really only just started to get going. I think it is not at all beyond the bounds of possibility that we're going to see a retest of the peak around 2000 before there are big questions asked of this bull market. The size of the base formation and the scale of currency debasement that is going on globally is something that is going to have a material impact on the popularity of gold. Now, this is still, I think, a hard sell. The quantities of gold that investors own, I think, is really quite low. And that is quite normal. It is usually when prices are extremely high that we see the biggest demand for any asset. Back in 2003, I joined David in Fuller Money. And we went out to, we were part of StockCube Research then. I was at a meeting with some of the other StockCube people with a potential consultancy client in Mayfair. And we were making the pitch. They were talking about the kind of research that they did. And I was talking about the kinds of things that we did at Fuller Money. And I mentioned that gold looked like a really impressive base formation completion. And I'll never forget what the chap said. He basically said, "Don't ever mention that in my presence." He had been so scarred by the bear market that had occurred in gold previous to the base formation completion that he couldn't bear to even think about the potential for additional upside. You lose a demographic every time there's a bear market. There are people who swear off it and never come back. But there is also the real potential then that there is a whole group of other people that have never invested in it. They're new to the market and they have sympathy with the world view. That's one of the most important things about gold, because there is always going to be a group of people who have a worldview that governments can't be trusted. And as long as asset prices are going higher, then that doesn't really become a pressing argument. It's when gold starts to do better. But most particularly when gold is doing better in currencies that are just beginning to turn. For example, we've already seen the fact that the Australian dollar was in positive territory and has broken its downtrend, but gold is going up faster than the Australian dollar. It's starting to go up faster against the New Zealand dollar. When we look at it in Brazilian real, then it is steadying within what has been a very tight consolidation. Perhaps the most important is the renminbi. Gold is not at a new all-time high against the renminbi, but it is steadying from above the 10,000 yuan level. Now, one of the most important points about the Chinese economy is that they have been able to sustain their economic growth rate over the last decade by expanding their debt load. The communist administration is now trying to prepare the domestic population for harder times. Then, of course, there is the continued trend towards surveillance and forcing people to abide by ever more strenuous rules. All of that is aimed at attempting to stem the tide of capital flight from the country. The pace of defaults that is occurring in the corporate sector continues to trend higher. We don't have the one big question about China that is literally unanswerable, so it is a known unknown, is what is the natural default rate for the economy. We have good data on that from the USA. We know what is normal because there have been a number of cycles where we've had defaults and reparations really in the bond markets. Well, defaults in China are now only about 4 years old. It has been trending higher every single year. We don't know what the average is in good times, and we certainly don't know what the worst case scenario is in bad times. What we do know is that China hasn't had a recession in about 30 years. And they badly need a hiatus to the trade war, and they need to help, or they need some form of global assistance in trying to reinvigorate growth. The biggest challenge that China has is that they're running a fixed exchange rate mechanism. The easy answer to reinvigorate growth in the Chinese economy would be to devalue the currency. But of course, that even if there was even a whiff that was imminent, there would be a massive capital flight. Therefore, what we can also think about is what they're trying to do is ensure that it is impossible for people to move their money overseas because they are preparing for a devaluation. And of course, that's an additional reason why the price of gold is going higher. And when we then think about what it is that people are trying to insulate themselves from, it is the debasement of fiat currencies. Well, of course, when the value of the currency goes down, then that acts as a tailwind for precious metals. It also acts as a tailwind for commodities, because commodities cannot simply be lent or printed into existence. The continuous commodity index has broken a year-long downtrend, and it is now starting to push back up towards the upper side of this range that's persisted now for nearly 4 years. But the bigger picture is that this is a lengthy base formation following what was an incredible decline from the peak put in 2011. I mean, the peak was close to 700. The eventual low was half that. And that is a significant decline for any asset class. What we're increasingly starting to see is that copper has got a generally similar pattern to the continuous commodity index. It's rallying from the lower side of a range that's persisted now for most of the last 12 months. When we then think about aluminium, it's also a very significant globally traded commodity, and it is now pushing back above its trend mean, and it's got this rounding characteristic over the last 6 months. Coffee prices are benefiting from the low season in terms of production and have clearly broken the downtrend. Cocoa prices are back in the region of the trend mean and started to find support there in here today. So that is helping to demonstrate support in and to hold the medium-term sequence of lower or higher reaction lows. But it is, I think, in what we might consider to be the clear food commodities, where palm oil, for example, is coming up to the upper side of a 7-year base formation and has been rallying in a very profound manner for most of the last 3 months. Wheat prices, it might be better to look at the second month continuation chart, but it is also coming up towards the upper side of what is effectively a 4-year base formation. If it clears the 600 cent level, then we'll be talking about a completed base formation. Rough rice has also been rallying of late and is coming back up towards the upper side of a 4-year base formation. But what I think is particularly important to realize is just how depressed these prices are, and that they are moving now in a really very dynamic manner at exactly the same time that the US dollar is starting to deteriorate and where there is the scope for a reflation trade. Then, of course, we have to consider that with commodity prices heading higher, then the one that has been less dynamic is oil. Oil prices, however, are back above the $65 area. They are firming from the region of the trend mean. There has been a broad-ranging environment persisting now for nearly 2 years. It hasn't quite yet been able to break the downward bias from the peak put in just above $80 at the end of last year. But we are still in a bullish environment. Now, there is the potential that with oil prices steady and commodity prices generally doing better, against a background where governments the world over are borrowing money hand over fist, that we are going to have an inflationary outcome. Well, if that is the case, then that should be positive for gold. It will be positive for commodity prices. If the value of the currency in our pockets is being debased, then it is positive for asset prices generally, which is one of the reasons why stock markets are doing better. It should also be beneficial for property prices. The problem, however, is that when we look at the valuations that are on a number of those asset classes, then property prices are at historically high levels in a significant number of countries because of the very low interest rate environment and the compression of yields resulting from quantitative easing and from ultra-low interest rates. So, in order to justify paying for these kinds of assets, one would really have to be betting that there's going to be a bubble. I think that's certainly true of the property prices in a number of the higher profile cities in the world, that there isn't a great deal of evidence yet to suggest that they are going to decline imminently. And I think when we think about the potential for an inflationary outcome, that would support their valuations. But on a relative value basis, as against the argument about which asset class is most likely to do best, well, then we're thinking I think we have to adjust the metrics. Then it is much easier for an asset that has been doing nothing for decades or a decade or has had a lengthy base formation for those to do better in an environment where we are getting an inflationary outcome would appear to be the easy answer. That is why gold is doing better. It's why commodities are doing better. And it's why European stock market indices are breaking on the upside. It's why the FTSE 100 has got this 3-year first step above the base, and why the FTSE 250, or the mid-caps, are doing so much better than the large-caps. They all benefit from the relative value argument, because they don't have the same overvaluation as a result of quantitative easing that, for example, bonds or property have. 10-year Treasury yields are bouncing once more from the 1.5% level there, and this continues to look like consolidation. Now, quite whether the yield is ready to push above the 2% level is debatable, but I don't think that there is there is much chance of the price the yield contracting below 1.5% anytime soon. Well, what that I think is beginning to really point to is we're going to see underperformance by the bond markets, outperformance by the stock markets, and outperformance by currencies, and that will be paid for through the debasement of fiat currencies, which is one of the primary hedge reasons for owning gold. Well, when we then think about what does this mean for us in terms of the secular bull market on equities, it's been liquidity fueled, and we're seeing the big question that was outstanding in 2018 was, where is the liquidity going to come from to support the next leg higher in the stock market? Well, we now have the answer to that question, because the Federal Reserve has added in $400 billion in 4 months. We have a succession of ranges, one above another. Each one of the ranges on the S&P 500 has lasted about a year and a half. The most recent one of those has now been completed, and it continues to push on the upside. And because we have this consistency, and because it has become progressively more obvious, well, that's why I tend to think of trends in terms of Heisinger's uncertainty principle. When the consistency of the trend becomes obvious, that really tells us less about where prices are going to go. Once people accept that the trend is consistent and that there is a broad pattern of outperformance, that during the trending phases, the 200-day moving average is the most appropriate. During the lengthy consolidations and volatile periods, then the 1,000-day moving average is more appropriate. And as soon as people understand that, well, this is a market. People always want to have relative performance. So what they try to do is anticipate the market. And that suggests that we are now entering the period where the pace of the advance could quite easily pick up, that we are going to see an acceleration phase, that the advance that is currently underway may be we're going to get some consolidation in the short term. We have plenty of evidence that the 200-day moving average has been an area of support following these lengthy periods of consolidation. So therefore, it's the most important touchstone in terms of this bull market. The one thing we can say about the consistency of the trend is that every time we've had a breakout, it has been sustained. And therefore, as long as that remains the case, we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. That doesn't necessarily mean that Wall Street is going to continue to be the relative strength leader. I think that there is clear scope for catch-up potential and outperformance by other markets. But this has been the market that has benefited most from quantitative easing, and it is likely to be the market that peaks first. Therefore, we do need to pay attention to what's happening on Wall Street. If this is still going to be a consistent trend, we can script what it is going to look like when it does end. As long as we're getting these moves, then we can script what the trend will look like. In other words, it is going to break higher and trend in a persistent manner for at least another year, at which point we will see a deep pullback, and that pullback will exceed the 200-day moving average. We would move into another lengthy period of consolidation, where the 1,000-day moving average would represent an area of support and an attractive buying opportunity. That is what we anticipate. Therefore, we can predict that the next period of volatility and ranging is likely to coincide with the 2020 U.S. presidential election, simply going on the rhythm of this market. If, on the other hand, we get a clear acceleration, an even more clear acceleration than we had in 2017, then that would be a trend ending. It would suggest that the medium-term trend is starting to become undone. But it's the 1,000-day moving average. It would be the clearest signal that the long-term trend is over. And we're a long way from drawing that kind of conclusion. This continues to be a secular bull market, and it continues to be animated not just by liquidity but by incredible technological innovation. The fact that it is primarily technology companies are the clear leaders in terms of the market cap. And I'm sorry we don't get the market cap for the S&P 500, but we know that the biggest cap companies in the world are Apple, Amazon, Google, Facebook, that the energy sector is much less significant in terms of global market cap than it used to be. There is a clear temptation to think that energy therefore represents clear value and that it should be bought at these levels. And even the yield on the energy sector now exceeds that of the utilities sector. So there is certainly an argument for owning energy for yield-hungry investors. But the reality is that secular bull markets on Wall Street do not coincide with secular bull markets in energy. And the most likely scenario is that we are in a lengthy ranging phase for oil prices, and that it would be rather rare that we're going to see sustained moves above $80 for the oil price. What that also suggests is that energy equities are going to be extremely volatile for the foreseeable future. When we think about what is the primary reason for that, it's because of technological innovation. It's because of shale oil and gas bringing to market a massive new source of supply at an attractive price. And that is upending the dynamics of the entire energy sector. What is increasing, I think, important to understand is that it is an expensive way of bringing oil to market, but it is also something that is quite different from conventional wells in that they can tailor their supply to the price environment. If prices fall, they can just stop drilling. And when they stop drilling, supply falls. That is not the same as with conventional wells. Therefore, it's a price-sensitive environment. The higher prices go, the more they will drill, the more that they can hedge their potential into the future, and that virtually ensures that prices come back down. The USA is now an energy exporter and one of the largest energy exporters in the world. It's certainly the largest producer of oil and gas, or at least oil right now. And that is an incredible change. What's also worth considering is that China is now importing more oil than the USA ever did. It has exceeded the 2005 peak in terms of US oil imports. China does have unconventional oil, but it's in incredibly mountainous areas, and that those areas are already highly susceptible to earthquakes. It is not quite the same as the rolling plains of Texas. If oil prices are going to range, then that removes a significant headwind to growth. We then have the clear potential that quantum computing is going to really have an incredible impact on security. It's going to have an incredible impact on our ability to answer different kinds of questions. The kinds of questions that scientists can ask is heavily influenced by the computing power they have at their disposal. When we have quantum computers, it opens up a different kind of question. It brings into the fore more probabilistic questions, and it introduces a multiple possible world theory. What we've also seen just in this week is the first transfer of information between two computers, which was effectively teleported without any previous connection between the two computers. And these kinds of innovations are coming through thick and fast. But then we also had the announcement this year of Google's quantum supremacy. And it is really rather irrelevant whether the speed with which they were able to reach their answer relative to a conventional supercomputer is 10,000 times faster or 50 times faster, but there's nobody debating whether it was in fact faster. And this was for a relatively primitive quantum computer. The trend is obvious, therefore. The trend is that this kind of technology is worthy of pursuing further, that there will be a much greater investment in additional quantum computing technology, and that it will reach commercial utility within the decade. And that is the kind of innovation that will drive a secular bull market. In previous cycles, it would have been enough on its own. But then when we think about what else is going on, we also have the fact that the healthcare sector is in a state of flux, because it represents one of the greatest taxes on consumption. Everyone is familiar with the fact that energy prices are a tax on consumption, but at least energy prices tend to move in cycles. Healthcare costs have only ever seemed to trend higher, and that is a massive source of a headwind for the ability of governments to fund themselves and for economic growth generally. Well, if we move from chronic conditions to cures, then that is a massive game changer, and it frees up vast quantities of additional productive capacity for huge innovation. Secular bull markets thrive on productivity growth, and the provision of cures to chronic conditions is the kind of thing that can really move the needle in terms of productivity growth. We have the fact that Tesla has been able to push on to new all-time highs in here this week. And this is a very meaningful move, particularly relative to the volatility that the share has been prone to, and also the negative commentary that it has been subject to. The reality is that that Tesla is now outselling every other electric vehicle globally. They've moved to 8-to-1-to-1 battery chemistries, which is delivering range that is, if not the best in the world, certainly among the most competitive of any battery manufacturer. One would obviously argue that they're not the ones manufacturing the batteries, but they do own the factories. And they have a ready supply of batteries for their own personal use, which is not something that any of the other automotive companies have. So Tesla continues to benefit from first mover advantage, and it is producing cars that people aspire to own. And that is a really very significant change, because there is certainly a debt issue for Tesla. But there are also debt issues for the other automotive companies. Some of the automotive companies globally are going to go bust. The question is whether it will be Tesla first or whether it will be some of the others first, because the global demand for electric vehicles is likely to continue to rise. If we just simply forget for the moment about the environmental concerns and think more about the regulatory concerns. The tax on motor fuel is a very significant source of revenue for governments. From a consumer's perspective, the total cost of ownership for an electric vehicle, when one considers the cost of recharging it compared to an internal combustion engine, makes clear sense if the cost of the vehicle approximates that of the internal combustion engine vehicle. When we eventually get autonomous vehicles, then that represents a massive challenge for the insurance sector. But from a consumer's perspective, it reduces the cost of insurance. In many cases, the cost of insurance approximates the monthly cost of the vehicle, at least in the USA. Therefore, anything that can reduce the insurance costs from consumers also represents a massive removal of a headwind to growth, and therefore the potential for productivity enhancements. I think that we also have the near-term rollout of 5G. What we've certainly seen is the semiconductors index has been resurgent over the course of the last 6 months, and a good part of the reason for that has been because of the rollout of 5G hardware in an increasingly large number of countries. We also have the birth of artificial intelligence and the increasing commercialization of artificial intelligence. And when that is exposed to the massive data collection that is occurring as a result of 4G and the potential for even more data collection resulting from 5G, then the increasing commercialization of artificial intelligence will ramp up accordingly. Then that is all helping to drive the cloud computing sector, and that alone is part of the reason why it is the big data companies have become the most significant in terms of global market cap. Well, that is, I think, those are the kinds of stories and narratives that are being built into the secular bull market. And all of that works as long as we continue to see the commercialization continue and the supply of additional liquidity to support the valuations. It is all about liquidity at this stage in the cycle. And we have the answer for where the additional liquidity is coming from. it is watching that liquidity situation is going to give us, I think, some of the clearest indications for when any of this might end. But there's no sign of it yet. What we are seeing, however, is that the interest in gold continues to rise, and that people are looking on it both as a recovery candidate, but also as a hedge against the worst inclinations of governments. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.